Hi, Deborah. Marcia.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Where are you calling from?
Hi.
San Francisco.
Great. Great. We'll say hello to you again once Nikki gets on.
Now, Deborah, you've been given the rundown on how to mute everybody. That's perfect.
Yeah, so I'll I'll introduce Nikki and then kind of pass over to you to discuss.
Sure. That's great.
So I'm on the line.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi, this is Ahmed Karim from Norwalk, Connecticut. How is everybody?
We're great. Thank
great.
You.
Good to hear you.
Hi, Dr. Karim. Nice to hear you.
Nice to hear you. Who's that?
It's Allison, Dr. Karim.
Oh, hi, Allison.
So, Deborah, it is 5:00.
Yes, great. Well, again, this is Deborah Casey. I'm filling in for Kim Aaliyah tonight, who's probably driving through a redwood forest as we speak, heading home. As director of the Homeopathic Academy of Southern California here in San Diego, I'm delighted for the opportunity to speak with Nikki Enriquez, a British homeopath, researcher, and writer whose latest book, Crossroads to Cure, is actually part of our curriculum in our 3-year certification program as a very clear and practical guide to successful case taking. It very clearly explains what to do after we take that initial case and the first dose of a remedy is given. Nicola graduated from the London College of Classical Homeopathy, had a busy London practice, and ran a free clinic within the British National Health Service before moving to California in 1995. Crossroads to Cure, her sixth book, takes the reader step by step through the process of that second prescription, discussing the full range of remedy actions and their interpretations. Among Nikki's other books are two on health issues affecting women, Menopause, the Women's View, and Hysterectomy, the Women's View. She's currently an instructor and the clinical director at the Institute of Classical Homeopathy in San Francisco. Allison Burden is also with us, head of DHR, Discount Homeopathic Resources, on books, tapes, and all kinds of helpful material. Allison, you want to explain a little bit about your...
Well, I'd just like to say that, you know, we're always pleased to have a great author come and give a teleconference because it's always so inspiring to hear the person speak when you're used to reading, you know, the great materials they produce. So as we usually do on these teleconferences, I'll just let people know that if they want to order Nikki's book, they can just ask for, just under special instructions when you order online, just say, can I have the 15% discount? And we'll make sure you get that little perk for that book. So take it away, Deborah.
Great. Well, I want to welcome everyone. Who do we have on tonight's call?
I'm Krishna speaking.
And where are you calling from?
Indiana.
Welcome. Who
else? I was in England for 23 years, and I haven't heard Nicola because where she was practicing.
Uh-huh. Well, welcome to tonight's talk. Anybody else?
It's Julie Inslee in North Carolina.
North Carolina. Well, welcome. Nice to have you.
Ilana.
Ilana Dow from Maryland.
Maryland.
Joe Guardino, Staten Island, New York.
Great.
Eric
Duvall
in Massachusetts.
Great. We've got four corners of the country here.
Yeah, Barbara from Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
My name is Alice in San Francisco.
Ilana from New York.
Uh-huh.
Margo from North California.
Uh-huh.
Sophia from San Francisco.
Great. Great to have you.
Deborah Crowley from Washington State.
Wonderful. Well, we have quite a range of the whole country here. Our format tonight will be about a 45-minute interview with Nikki, and then we'll open up the questions from the callers.
Welcome.
Nikki?
Hello.
I'd like to start by asking you to let everyone know exactly who you are.
Well, as you kindly said in the introduction, I'm first and foremost a writer, which is how I earn my living for many years prior to having an epiphany and turning out to be a homeopath. So that's my background and teaching, of course, in many other kinds of topics and things. I was writing a book on the menopause, the one you mentioned, and I was interviewing the leading practitioners of complementary medicine in the UK at the time, because I thought that there has to be something other than HRT to give people who are feeling uncomfortable during that time. And among those I interviewed was Misha Norland, a very well-known and very highly esteemed British homeopath.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to his explanation of the goals and the skills of a homeopath, and finally I knew what it was I was put on this earth to accomplish, and I immediately began to follow that particular path to become a homeopath. I've been studying homeopathy since 1986, that's about 20 years now, and as you said, I graduated with honours from the London College of Classical Homeopathy, and I'm also a British certified teacher of homeopathic medicine.
Uh-huh.
My first and foremost teacher, because I think everyone is always interested to know who teaches us,
right,
is Hahnemann,
uh-huh,
and then Kent,
uh-huh,
and then comes Sheila Creasy. Sheila Creasy was my main teacher of philosophy, homeopathic philosophy, at the London College of Classical Homeopathy, and I'm indebted to her for her vision and for her directing me through the texts and so on, and to render what some people find a very complicated science simple. Sheila was taught by Noel Puddifat, and he, in turn, was taught by John Henry Clark. So that's my lineage, and I can track it right back to Hahnemann. So that tells you a little bit about me and who I am.
And so did the women's health studies bring you to homeopathy?
Not really the women's health studies. I think what it was, having been an interviewer,
mm-hmm,
if you like, a sort of professional case taker, I suppose,
mm-hmm,
doing interviews for my journalism, I realized when I was talking to Misha that actually it made use of those research skills and those communication skills that I already had in a very different way. And I think that's how a lot of homeopaths come to be doing the job. They have a lot of life experience skills, which they then adapt to being a homeopath, and I think that that's really what I did.
In your opinion, what is the goal of healing with homeopathy?
Well, the goal of healing with homeopathy is to restore balance throughout the organism. And that means balance on all the various planes, on the mental plane, the emotional plane, and, of course, the physical plane.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I think the ultimate goal is to restore, as Hahnemann says, people back to health as quickly as we can. And that, for me, means health. You know, when we have them really healthy, it means them not using even homeopathy at all, being completely without any medicine at all in any way, shape, or form, just being entirely themselves, fulfilling their full potential and enjoying their lives and having a very vigorous life force energy. So that, for me, is healing via homeopathy.
And why do you practice strictly, according to Hahnemann?
Well, in my training, I had the good fortune to be taught by many teachers. I find it to be the most simple and effective way to restore health. The reason I find it effective is that if we study the organon, Hahnemann provides in that text easy-to-follow instructions, based, as he said, on clearly comprehensible principles of practice. And I have found, by applying his philosophy exactly to the letter, in other words, in terms of exactly how he instructs us to do that, that these complex disorders that we are faced with these days are very quickly transformed into simple disorders, and therefore rendering them much easier to cure and, of course, increasing their potential for gentle, rapid, and permanent cure. I have found that in studying Hahnemann as extensively and deeply as I have done over the years, is that his teachings are very systematic, and I'm a very methodical person. I like to have a structure and follow that structure. It enables me to relax when I'm taking on a difficult task like restoring someone's health. And I think the other thing that's most important about Hahnemann's teachings, because often we get told that homeopathy doesn't have a science, but if we follow his methodology to the letter, what we're able to do daily in our practice is to very easily replicate everything that he proved to be effective in curing people. And I think, as I said, that's so important because it offers an opportunity for all of us to re-verify the amazing experiments that Hahnemann conducted, and we can do that again and again in our daily practice. So for me, following Hahnemann allows us to practice true science, which, of course, goes against many of our people who criticize homeopathy as something that is a little bit off the planet, so to speak, and to be ridiculed. So I think it's if we follow Hahnemann, then we can all become true scientists because we're conducting an experiment, really, every day of our lives in practice.
Right. At the Academy here in San Diego, we feel that Hahnemann is the foundation and is homeopathy. And without that strong foundation, there really isn't anything else to build on.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. He is he tells us exactly what to do. I mean, you know, the Organon, the sixth edition, there's everything in that book to tell you what to do, including all the ways in which we can make the most ghastly errors. And then, obviously, because he's obviously a great teacher, he tells us how to correct those errors. And I think the challenge and what's difficult is that the text is you have to read between the lines in terms of what he's saying. It's not always very clear.
Right.
But certainly, if we take the time to study it, we could have no greater guide to effective practice.
That's what we tell our students is when they study the Organon, as soon as you're done with it, go back to page one and read it again and again and again because it's all in there. And,
yes, that's right. My teacher, Sheena Creasy, told me that she'd read it 1,000 times. Of course,
mm-hmm.
When she was teaching me, she was in her 70s, and she had 45 years of practice. I'm obviously not that old, although I'm getting there. But I do that, personally speaking, because of the kind of work that I do. I reread the Organon twice every year,
mm-hmm.
and every time I read it, I find something more incredibly enlightening, which, of course, I endeavor to pass on to my students.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's a wonderful foundation and encouraging for those of us who don't have Hahnemann's genius to have a path to follow and a place to find the answers.
Correct.
Could you define you talk a lot about the second prescription. Could you describe that treatment phase for us?
Well, the second prescription is really the complete A through Z thought process. And another way of looking at it is the complete case management activity plan, following, of course, the administration of the first prescription. In that phase of what we all know as second prescription, what we're trying to do there is we're trying to understand the exact meaning of the client's experience after ingesting the remedy. We're trying to come to a very clear understanding of the exact meaning of the life force energy's response to the medicine. For example, what is the current state of the life force energy? Has it changed? If it has changed, how has it changed? Has it changed for better or worse, or has it not changed at all? And that is really, you know, what we're talking about in my understanding of the second prescription phase. I think the analysis falls roughly into these four categories. I'm summing it up very briefly because the interview is very short. But the first category, I'd say, is the correct remedy and the correct potency. And we're able to understand that that's happened because what we observe when we're interviewing and looking at the client again, examining the client again, that rapid cure has occurred without aggravations of any of the symptoms that they experienced prior to receiving the medicine. And that, of course, is the ideal response. That's what everybody's after. I think that's probably, you know, what we call a similimum. In the same, under the same heading, a brief aggravation after ingesting the remedy followed by rapid amelioration on all levels. That would be the mental level, the physical level, and the emotional level. That would be another extremely good response. Another good response, indicating that we had the correct remedy and the correct potency, would be that old symptoms that the person experienced in the past are observed to reappear and disappear in accordance with the correct direction of cure. So that would be all of those would be signs that we were actually on the button with our prescription. Then the second category, again, I'm reminding everybody that I'm summing this up very briefly, is that we have the right remedy, but we've got the wrong potency. And that, of course, can happen to us a lot of the time because the selection of potency, whereas Hahnemann, you know, started with 1C and then worked his way up to, you know, the 30C and then 200, and then, of course, he developed the LMs. But we, unfortunately, don't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 like that. What we're left with in terms of the pharmacies giving us the potencies, we have much bigger gaps between each potency. So trying to select the right potency is a huge challenge, I think. So what we have, if we have the right remedy and the wrong potency, is that we have a long aggravation of the symptoms with final slow improvement. And that kind of response of the life force energy to the medicine usually indicates what Kent calls the borderland curability potential. And so what you would see by that response is that the potential for cure perhaps is less than it is in other cases. So that's always a good indicator to know what on earth it is that you're dealing with there and whether or not cure is possible. So that's the second category. And then there's the third one, and that is the wrong remedy, too high potency. And that is a little bit similar to the category before. A long aggravation, only this time, instead of having a final slow improvement, what we have is the final decline of the sick person. And as Kent says, we're signing the death certificate. So that is a situation that's one to avoid, so to speak. And then we have the fourth category, and that is the wrong remedy, which has arisen due to symptomatic treatment. And by that I mean prescribing not on the symptom image totality, but on a single symptom. So as opposed to looking at the whole person and considering all the symptoms on all the planes of the organism, for some reason we're focusing on just one single symptom and prescribing on that. And what happens then is that that single symptom that we've prescribed upon, there's an amelioration of that symptom. Mm-hmm. Or the physical symptoms go away. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's no special relief of the person. So in themselves, the person does not feel better. So what we have is a single symptom disappearing or a physical symptom, but there's no relief of the person at the innermost. Another example of having the wrong remedy due to symptomatic treatment is that the symptoms that the person came with, they take the wrong direction. And again, I'm saying the same thing in a different way. So what we would have is the outermost of the individual improves and the innermost worsens. And that would give us the same indication of that error. And then, of course, the other thing is that we give the first prescription, and that's followed there's some amelioration, but that amelioration is very short-lived, and it's followed very rapidly by an aggravation. And that is what we call too short relief of symptoms. So that also would indicate that we hadn't got it on the button at all. And I think that, as I said, I want to remind people that I'm trying to be very brief about this phase of treatment for time reasons. But I think that those are the basic potential responses. But what you have to always remember is that due to something called individuality, every sick person is unique in who they are and why they're sick and all the rest of it. So there are, in fact, a multitude of variations on the themes that I've just put forward there. And if I can just plug the book, that's the reason for the book, Crossroads to Cure, because in the book I dissect these responses in much more detail and then give action plans for managing them. But that's very briefly what I perceive the second prescription to be all about.
And in what way is the logic of the second prescription different from the first prescription?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. In Hahnemann's homeopathy, the first prescription assessment is by the observation of all the signs of suffering that the homeopath perceives. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at when the person presents to us, we're looking at the state and the degree of the disturbance of the life force energy. So the symptoms that the person comes to us with, it tells the homeopath, how far the life force energy, without any assistance, has managed to vent the disturbance from the core of the person outwards. So that's what we're assessing in the moment in which we're trying to cure the person and finding that first remedy.
Is that similar to how compensated?
I beg your pardon?
Is that similar to how compensated, you know, how compensated their state is? That's sometimes something we refer to as far as, you know, the life energy, you know, how compensated it has been from the disturbance.
Yes, I think perhaps a clear way of putting it is that you know, the life force energy is our survival mechanism. And so what it's trying to do all the time is to enable the organism to survive the onslaught of whatever it is. And what we see is, my understanding is that when a client presents to me, what I'm seeing is the SOS message of the life force energy sending up a smoke signal saying, I'm in desperate trouble here. I'm struggling to enable the organism to survive, and I just can't do it. And this is the best I can do. So what we've got pain or swelling or inflammation or whatever it is, which you know, vents for this disturbance that's going on at the innermost. So in a way, adaptation, what you've got there is the organism trying to adapt to this disturbance ineffectively, so to speak. Now, in the second prescription assessment, what we're doing is we're reviewing those same symptoms and those signs, and what we're doing is we're assessing to what degree the life force energy is now free of the burden of suffering. So how many and how much and to what degree the symptoms that the person came with has gone away. and whether or not cure has been achieved in whole or in part, and how the whole cure has occurred or how only part of it has occurred, and why. And that's what the second prescription assessment is how it differs, the logic of it. Of course, in both the first and second prescription phases, as you said, we're assessing the life force energy's curative versus non-curative response. In other words, how far it's managed to exteriorize and vent the disturbance at the center and continues to do so, or whether or not, because we found the right remedy, the organism's susceptibility to the medicine allows their suffering to be resolved, so that therefore there's no need for the life force energy to go on venting through inflammation, headaches, or discharges of some kind.
Second prescription seems to be a challenge for most of us. What do you feel are the most common pitfalls to avoid in the second prescription?
Well, here I think there are a million of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I make them every day. And I think that the reason that we fall foul and we succumb to the errors that we make is basically lack of self-confidence. And it's lack of confidence in what it is that we're doing. So I'm going to run through, several pitfalls that there are things I've done wrong, so it's always good to use oneself as an instrument of education.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think that there's confusion about the correct and indirect direction of cure. I think a lot of our problem comes is because we've misunderstood the way that works.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we can all recite it together, so I won't bother to do that. The correct direction of cure means that the person is better at the innermost and worse at the outermost. That would be the correct direction of cure. Then I think another pitfall is that we're too impatient. And I think that this is particularly a problem when we're new homeopaths. We still have this fix-it mentality, which, of course, you've got to lose if you mature into an effective homeopath, because impatience is really, really the thing that's going to kill you and probably kill the patient as well. So the thing is to avoid the impatience. And that means not allowing the life force energy to enough time to respond, to work, in other words, without interruption. And then what we do is we prescribe too early, and perhaps we repeat the medicine too early. So that's sort of too early repetition. Then I think another problem is that we prescribe on a moving target. So what we're doing is, rather than allowing a state to settle into whatever it is, and by allowing the state to settle, we obtain much more clarity. What we tend to do is we'll prescribe for that moving state instead of a static one. And that causes us to change remedies a lot more frequently than in fact we need to.
I'm sure we've all had patients that call regularly talking about their current issue, wanting to address that current issue. And like you said, you're addressing a very small piece rather than able to look at the whole picture.
Yes, I think that succumbing to pressure is a terrible challenge. I think it's when you have to have your feet firmly on the ground and know what it is you're doing and what view you're taking. And then, of course, the way I tackle that is to very clearly articulate to the client exactly why they feel the way they do, and then that empowers them to understand their situation and enables them to go through perhaps increased pain because there's a purpose in it. And I think most of my students know this little phrase that I repeat probably ad nauseum, which is education rather than medication. And the reason that I follow that rule is because of the principle of the minimum dose, and that there's nothing less than nothing, which is the minimum dose. So why medicate when you can actually educate somebody you know, back to health. So that's how I generally get around dealing with pressure from patients. Of course, one's got to know what one's doing in order to explain it to somebody. I think another problem that is too common amongst all of us is complacence, and that's leaving the person on the wrong remedy too long. And I think that that happens to us, particularly if you have a client that you've had for some years, and you tend to sort of, you know, the challenge isn't there, if you like,
mm-hmm.
and maybe the interest has gone a little bit. And, you know, you want something a little bit more exciting to think about that day. And so you don't put the energy of the thought process into challenging yourself as to whether or not the person's been on the remedy too long. And I think that this problem of leaving the person on the remedy too long is particularly difficult when you've prescribed a remedy that is not the similimum. It's acting in part. And then, of course, it's much less easy to see that the person's been on the remedy, the wrong remedy, too long. Then another thing that happens is that we get confused about when to act and when to wait, and then when to wait actively. So I think that that's always a problem. Again, you're going to come back to, you know, pressure of the sick person. Always, you know, that's going to be the obstacle that we're always going to have to get around. So when to act, when to wait, and when to actively wait, and clarifying when we need to do all of those things. I think another pitfall, I hope I'm not boring people by all these pitfalls, is the misunderstanding of the state of the life force energy
mm-hmm.
at the time of the first prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And how that's going to impact the analysis. For example, administering the wrong potency and then actually not understanding that the overreaction of the life force energy in the sick person was due to that error. And I think that's how that comes about. So, you know, trying to understand very clearly what one's dealing with, you know, in the first prescription phase is incredibly important. Then I think another pitfall is forgetting about the impact of changing life circumstances of sick people and not paying enough attention to the fact that looking at, you know, if somebody loses somebody or has some kind of a shock, evaluating whether or not the person's response to that shock is actually appropriate or not. And I think we come unstuck there. So again, we might change remedies, whereas in fact what we need to do is to allow the person to recover from the shock just naturally and then get back on track and begin cure, you know, commence the completion of cure again. So I think it's not paying attention to changing life circumstances and how that impacts the individual.
Right.
And then I think forgetting about the symptom image totality. And again, that comes in when we're talking about, you know, the patient is on the phone to you all the time complaining of the headache, only the headache, just treat the headache, just let me get rid of this head pain. If you do that, you know, I'll give you an extra bonus. That's the idea. You know,
uh-huh.
that's what they're on about.
Right.
And what you have to say to them is, look, yes, you've got a head pain, but then look at everything else
mm-hmm.
that's been going on,
mm-hmm.
and you haven't got this and you haven't got that. You know, what you're left with is the head pain.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually that will go like everything else has gone,
mm-hmm.
and then they're able to pick up the ball and run a little bit further with it. Then the other pitfall is not listening deeply to the report that you get. In other words, not gathering all the information necessary to evaluate the second prescription phase accurately. Not keeping accurate records. Not monitoring a case appropriately. For example, you know, you've got a different monitoring timing thing between an acute state and a chronic state. So in acute state, you're going to monitor frequently, and in a chronic state, there's going to be less frequent monitoring, unless, of course, they're on the LMs. I think lack of understanding how to and why we need to adjust potency levels. I think confusing a return of an old symptom with a new one and vice versa. I think not reviewing the case in the context of the timeline so that you can confirm the correct and incorrect direction of cure as the symptoms disappear in the reverse order of their appearance, for example. I think prescribing more than one remedy at a time, the reason I think that's a pitfall is that you can't understand which ones worked and which one didn't work, and therefore you don't know which one to repeat and move the case along to cure. I think prescribing routinely is definitely a pitfall. By that I mean all injuries get arnica. Not all injuries will recover if you give arnica. I think not thinking clearly and logically before you take any action. I think that's a huge pitfall. I think it's this instant sort of gratification thing that we all fall foul of. We've got to do something immediately. That's not always a good idea. And again, we come back to the thing that you and I have been repeating, is that not saying no, I'm not going to do anything at this moment in time, when the client is pressurizing us to act, either for themselves or a close family member, and not seeing the wisdom of waiting, and that wisdom actually dictates waiting. So I think that, you know, I've just gone through quite a few opportunities for error, and I think if we all wise up to the fact there's room for human error, and the main point is to understand, first of all, that we've actually made a mistake. And I think that takes a huge amount of humility to say, I've actually made a blunder. And then we have to understand how to rectify it. And again, that's the point of my book, is assuming we're going to make an error. Just get that right out there. We're all going to muck it up one way or another at some time in our lives because none of us are perfect. And you hold yourself in a prison if you keep up this idea that you're going to be a perfectionist. But at least understand that why you've made the error and then how to get out of it.
When do you feel a remedy should be changed?
Well, when the previous remedy, when you've assessed that the remedy that you gave has ceased to act.
Uh-huh.
And what happens then is that the way you do that is, of course, is you don't change the remedy until you've assessed that the whole of the state of the person has changed. So again, it's changes on the whole plane of the organism. The mental, physical, and emotional state of the client has changed. And then because the state has changed, the remedy that you had given them before obviously doesn't fit the new state. And that is why you would change the remedy. So it's the whole state, because we're always treating the whole person, not the part of the person, in the chronic state, of course. And this also works in the acute as well. But it's always the whole state. So you're wanting the whole state to change before you're going to change the remedy.
And what's your understanding for exactly how homeopathic remedies work?
Well, here I'm going to actually be very controversial. I mean, some people think I'm that anyway, but this is how the reputation arrives,
mm-hmm.
is that remedies don't work. And what it is the life force energy is working.
Mm-hmm.
And the life force energy is working in response to the medicine.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to go into that a little bit more deeply. I realize we've got about 5 minutes, but I think it's an incredibly important point because mm-hmm. many people think it doesn't matter that we don't know how homeopathy works, but I think it's frightfully important that we do. So my understanding from Hahnemann's teachings is that there are three mechanisms in play. We're utilizing two laws of nature, the law of action and reaction, and the law of similars. And it's a combination of those two, plus the utilization of the dynamization preparation process of the homeopathic medicine. And I want actually to refer people to particular references. So if we look at the Organon, paragraph 63, in there, Hahnemann states, every agent, every medicine acts upon the vitality, and in degree deranges the vital force and causes a certain alteration in health for a longer or shorter period. The certain alteration in health, the disharmony, is experienced by the individual as discomfort, disturbance in degree, manifesting as symptoms. If we go to Hahnemann's Chronic Diseases, Volume 1, Preface to the 5th Volume, pages in Roman numerals 18 and 19, Hahnemann there states, by itself, our organic vital force is only sufficient to maintain the unimpeded progress of life. Being only an organic vital force intended to preserve an undisturbed health, unassisted, the vital force offers to the hostile disturbance either no equal opposition or resistance, or at best, it offers only a weak resistance. So unassisted, our vital force can't overcome even slight acute diseases and can't restore some sort of health without sacrificing a part, and often it's a large part, of the fluid and solid parts of the organism through a so-called crisis. And this is what Hahnemann calls the primary action of the vital force. So in this primary action response, the life force attempts to eliminate the disturbance. In degree, that vital force harms itself and the organism. If you like, a critical error is committed. So now what has to happen is that that error has to be corrected. So to rectify the error, reestablish harmony, preserve life, the vital force must endeavor to oppose its own harmful energy, in other words, the sacrifice of the fluid and solid parts, and overpower its own harmful energy. And the question then comes, how is it achieved? As always, Hahnemann has the answer. He explains it in the Organon, paragraph 64. And there he says, so for the second time, as it were, the automatic life-preserving vital force rouses itself, proportionate to its own energy, to develop the exact opposite condition. That is harmony replacing disharmony. And this secondary response goes by the name secondary action or counteraction response of the vital force to the primary response. Now, this is not Hahnemann, this is Henriquez talking. So what we see, the most easy way to see that is the acute state resolves rapidly without the aid of medicine of any kind, and that would be a good example of this. Of course, the successful resolution of sickness without assistance obviously is dependent entirely on the strength of the vital force prior to that alteration of health. So if you were healthy prior to the alteration, then you're going to come out of it a lot more quickly. So let's assume that assistance is necessary, and again quoting Hahnemann and Chronic Diseases. So to assist the vital force in preserving life, what the homeopath does is to employ the law of similars. And we observe the losses, in other words, those sacrifices, the losses inflicted on the organism by the life force energy. And what we do is we select a homeopathic medicine which has been proven to possess the power to simulate the losses, those sacrifices, and then via this wonderful tool of potentiation, dynamization, we have to attract the life force energy. So we magnify. What happens is that potentiation magnifies those losses to the vital force. So we're harnessing the power of this secondary action, Hahnemann says, the counteraction response. So by slightly altering the dose each time it's administered, what we do is we gradually cause and compel that life force energy to counteract, to react against the rightly chosen remedy. This is Hahnemann talking. So we increase its resistance energies in degrees, and we increase them more and more, he says, and at last we increase that resistance energy to such a degree that it becomes far more powerful than the original disharmony disease. And that's the consequence of that secondary action, is that the life-preserving power and the vital forces re-established into harmony, and the apparent increase of the disharmony caused by the homeopathic medicine, obviously because it's dynamic, it disappears. And as soon as we see the preponderance of the restored vital force, in other words, the restored state of balance and harmony throughout the organism, we are going to then cease administering that homeopathic medicine, and cure will occur as a consequence. And we're almost out of time here for me to go blabbing on, but if you look at paragraph 59 of the Organon, Hahnemann gives us 15 examples of this law of action and reaction.
Well, thank you for this fascinating explanation. I know I speak for all of our students, and I'm sure everyone listening, how incredibly valuable this is, because we do get stuck as homeopaths, and to have such deep understanding of what we're trying to do and where to go is just so valuable to us. I'd like to open up now to questions, but before I do, is there anything else we can look forward to hearing from you? Is there anything you're working on now?
I've got lots of projects in the pipeline percolating away here, so yes, there will be something coming down the pike very soon.
Fabulous. Well, I'd like to open it up now to our callers. If there's anyone that would like to ask Nikki.
Can I start? I'm Krishna speaking.
Okay.
Well, Nikki, I was in England from 1979 to 1993. I was practicing homeopathy there. I don't know, I didn't hear you that time, but I came here in 1993.
Uh-huh.
And I actually have got a really, I was so wonderstruck in England, and because I was a medical doctor and then I undertook homeopathy, and it's marvelous results there. Of course, it was acute prescribing. But here I'm really stuck. And for my own self as well, that I've just, as you said, the prescription, I was in acute pain because of replacement of the knee, and I was on those drugs, which only I had to take every hour. And then I was so fed up, and so I had the courage and to study my own case because nobody was able to help me. So I took acid nitric, which at that time matched my symptoms.
You know, we don't have too much time to understand
the case, but do you have a question? 1 minute more.
Yes.
And that acid nitric actually helped the pain completely. But then was it my just the symptomatic thing? And but it didn't do anything else except took away the pain. And similarly, I find here also that those arthritic things, it takes away the pain and they feel better. But then the pain comes back. So it is a very transient action it has. So why in these acute pains, the person gets relief, but not the whole relief?
Yes, well, that's exactly right. You see, you're getting relief in one part of the body, but
yeah.
Of course, what's not happening is that your life force energy is not being rekindled into health from the innermost. You know, you have pain in a limb. This is sort of the outermost. So you're just dealing with the outermost of your organism instead of dealing with the innermost and the outermost. So that's why you would need to have chronic constitutional treatment, and then that will deal with your chronic pain in the knee.
But acute crisis, is it? Can we do that in acute crisis?
The acute case taking, whether it's an acute or a chronic situation, you're always taking the mental and emotional as well as the part of the body that's afflicted. So you have to do that, otherwise you won't get long-lasting cure. You'll get temporary relief, which is just what allopathy does. you won't get long-lasting cure. And, of course, we're as homeopaths, we're offered permanent cure, which means long-lasting.
If the acute pain actually is relieved and you have taken all those mental and emotional factors also, but it goes, but then it goes for few days and then it comes back.
Well, that's why you know you haven't got the right remedy, because if you had the right remedy, it would go away. So that's how you know. You just need to be on a more appropriate remedy.
But is it? Can it do damage to the patient? Suppose we prescribe and that only had good effect for 2 days, and then it comes back. So will
but
it
I
do
think
any damage?
If you're repeating the wrong remedy over and over again, of course there are certain disadvantages to that. And so really, it would be better for you to find a remedy that gives you more than temporary relief, because there are certain, you know, there are, as I said, deep disadvantages to taking the wrong remedy again and again and again.
The least
of which is actually not bringing about cure, which is what you're after.
Thank you, Nikki. Is there someone else that has a question?
Well, I would like to ask, I'll make my question short, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm Joel from Staten Island.
Okay.
Lovely to meet you.
Hi. Nicola, I was just, you know, in listening to everything and also, you know, reading your book many times, and you explain about the second prescription and, you know, on how we determine the second prescription. And also you make it clear about if we may be on the wrong potency. But my question is, do you have a method, or do you use any type of method to help you determine the potency from the beginning?
Oh, yes. You know, of course, you can't. I do this better on a blackboard. But if you look at, if you understand that the life force energy is at the core, and that what it's doing is any discomfort is it's finding a vent. So what you if you want to penetrate the core, you have to give the minimum dose. Now, this gets us into the argument of highs and lows. And, of course, as I'm very strictly a Hahnemannian, for Hahnemann, a 30C was a high potency, and a 200C would be an even higher potency. So, you know, you're trying to get the remedy to penetrate the core of the organism. And if the higher up you go, so let's say a 30C in some circumstances you see would be seen to be a high potency and would do very well even in a very highly disturbed mental state. Of course, Kent would use, you know, much higher potencies, a 1M, a CM, or an MM, even just to start off. I'm not that confident. It's really perceiving how far has the organism vented the disturbance, and that'll tell you how energetic it is. So if everything's on the skin, that'll tell you that the energy's very up there, it's up and running, because the skin is the least vital organ of the body, and everything's on the surface. So you don't need to penetrate as far as perhaps a mental state, in which case you will need a higher potency. But certainly I think maybe that's my next book, is potency, because very few of us have the courage to discuss it. But I think that's the method that I use. I look at the person and I say, if the life force energy has pushed it, the mental and emotional state isn't really very much involved, it's in the physical body, then you don't need as high a potency as if the mental and emotional state is the priority place for the disturbance. And that's very briefly how I would look at it. That's a very simple explanation, again, because we don't have time.
I know. This opens up a whole line of questioning now for me.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's why, you have to, you know, the interviews are great, but then we get into our wonderful discussions. But that's my method.
Uh-huh. You see, though, so I see, though, that if the vital force, or if the disease is very deep, And going into the emotional mental level,
mm-hmm.
you're saying that we should use a, it would call for a higher potency.
Yes.
However, if the disease is on the mental and emotional level, could it be, isn't it true that the vital force is weaker? And if the vital force is weaker, can it handle a higher potency?
Well,
see, I often wonder about that.
Well, you have to understand what potency is all about. Potency is about potentiation, is making the medicine, putting it into a state in which the life force energy can take it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why we dilute the whole time and we give it energy. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to give the minimum dose. So the higher you go, if you like, the less remedy you're giving. So a weaker person, for example, if you think about the LMs, which are diluted one part to 50,000,
right.
That's a very high dilution.
Uh-huh.
That's a very high potency.
Yes.
And those are the LM is a wonderful condition, a wonderful potency to give for people who are very seriously ill, who
uh-huh.
hardly have any life force energy at all.
I see.
Where
okay.
it's just a little spark, because you need to very gradually build up that spark until it's actually a rip-roaring flame. And so that's what potency is about.
Uh-huh.
So although we're giving a high, you mustn't misunderstand high meaning strong.
Right.
Low is strong.
Uh-huh.
You know, a 6D
yes.
Has much more substance in it.
Right.
Therefore, it's much stronger because it's much more crude.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the higher up the scale you are, the lesser the substance there is, the more dynamic it is, because you need the medicine to be taken up by the life force energy, and which on the mental level, of course, is much weaker than on the preventing process, just on the physical
plane. I see. Okay, that's very okay. I see. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Does that help you?
Okay, that does very much.
Good.
Yes, thank you for that.
You're most welcome.
Okay.
Anyone else?
This is Ahmed here. Miss Nicola, Dr. Nicola Henry, are you somebody who takes cases at the Institute in California?
Well, we have a teaching clinic, which, you know, is in order to teach students how to take cases. So that's where I see people in the Institute. So what you need to do is to call up the Institute and get on the list there to be seen.
Is there a telephone number that you have?
Oh, yes, 415-551-1020. 415-551-1020.
Well, thank you. When can one call?
Well, you can just call any old time. The message machine is on, and somebody will get back to you.
Sheila Creasy was also my teacher. I studied with her for 6 years.
Aha!
Uh-huh. I was completely delighted with it. I have 6 years of notes that I took.
Well, we have a teacher in common. How wonderful.
I don't know where she is now.
Well, I assume that she's still in England teaching away there.
She was absolutely marvelous.
That's absolutely right.
We may have time for
one. Thank you for sharing.
Is there anyone with a quick question?
She mentioned arnica being not appropriate for all physical trauma. I know that's true in dentistry. I wonder if there's anything else.
Well, I just think it's about not prescribing routinely. I think that... for example, let's say, you know, you've sort of fallen over and you've turned your ankle. Maybe in the first stages it is arnica because it's bruising and swelling, but then it might go into a rooted state and then finally into a calc state. So, you, as I said, that, you know, don't always think that all injuries need arnica because they may not. And I can't think off the top of my head, you know, of things, but that's the point I'm trying to get across there is don't prescribe therapeutically because that's not homeopathy.
All right, thank you.
Well, I'd like to join all of our callers in thanking Nikki Enriquez with this incredibly valuable and practical treasure of hints on how to, where to go after that first prescription and what to do and not to be afraid of waiting and allowing that minimum dose to take hold of the vital force. And we look forward to more of your work. I'm excited about the idea of a book on potency, and I'm sure our students are going to be thrilled to find more information about that. Thank you so very much. Thank you. 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 Thank you.
Bye.